PPI.org.
Joining Disability in Progress, where we bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. I'm Mylan. Sam Jasmine produces this show, and Charlene Dahl is a research woman and makes great banana bread.
Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you, Mylan. Tonight, the topic is Parkinson's, and we'll be talking about that and all that's happening currently with the disease. Meanwhile, Dr. Gerald Vitek is with us, and he is MD, PhD professor, and chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Minnesota Medical School and neurologist with University of Minnesota Health. Good evening, Dr. Vitek.
Good evening.
I hope I got all that right.
Oh, you did. Right on.
So thank you very much for agreeing to be on, and this is a always been a pretty interesting topic to me because we'll get into it later, but I think there is some real famous faces with this disease. But I want you to start talking to me about, like, what made you choose your medical path?
Well, that's an interesting question. Actually, I grew up in a small town in northern Minnesota. It's called Meadowlands, Minnesota. I think they had 23 kids in my high school class. And early on, for some reason, I can't explain exactly why, I got interested in medicine. Came down here to Minneapolis, went to graduate school, and also went to medical school, and enjoyed the classes that dealt with the brain and brain disorders. And that's kind of how I ended up moving into this field.
Excellent. Well, let's start out by, if you would, I think people have seen it, but they don't really know a definition. So can you give us kind of a layperson's definition of what Parkinson's is and how it works?
Well, it's what we call a progressive neurodegenerative disease, which just means that there are cells in the brain that degenerate or die over time. And then based on the type of cells that die, that's the kind of disorder or disability you get. In Parkinson's disease, there are cells that make dopamine deep in the brain, and those cells tend to die out a little quicker than they do in the normal population. And when those cells die out, you lose dopamine, and then you develop a lot of the problems that Parkinson's patients develop. It's that lack of that chemical that causes it.
I think people hear about dopamine a lot, but can you tell people what dopamine does and what it is?
Well, it does a lot of things, actually. It's not just involved in Parkinson's disease. It can be involved in mood disorders, people, with depression or other problems, even psychiatric problems. There's a wide variety of things that dopamine does. When you lose dopamine in a certain part of the brain, mm-hmm. called the basal ganglia, and we each have two sets, one on each side of the brain, deep in the brain. When you lose that dopamine, those structures, which are responsible for a variety of things, including movement, it leads to disorder of movement. And the Parkinson's patients manifest primarily as about half to 70% of the patients get tremor, which is an involuntary shaking. Could be in the hands, it can involve the legs or the head, but usually it's in the arms or hands. You get stiff, so the limbs can feel stiff, and they're slow, so they have a lot of trouble with movements. Movements are all slowed quite a bit. And there's a paucity of typical movement that you and I do spontaneously, mm-hmm. eye blinking, facial expressions, people, for example, rolling in bed at night, blinking, people blink less, and gait and balance disorders. So those are some of the classic things you see in patients with Parkinson's disease.
And what causes Parkinson's?
Well, you know, we don't know. It's what we call most 85% of the cases are what we call sporadic. We don't have a known cause for it. 15% are generally linked somehow genetically. You know, there are a variety of different genetic changes that people have found, mm-hmm. and about 15% of people will have that. But the vast majority really don't. And the arguments that people have made and what really kind of come down to, it's a combination of genetic and environmental factors that probably contribute to this.
Are there different types of Parkinson's? And if so, talk a little bit about them.
Well, when we look at Parkinson's patients, we do kind of categorize them. I would say there's a saying that we all have, and that's Parkinson's patients are like snowflakes. There's no two that are alike.
Oh, geez.
But you can kind of group them. I mean, mm-hmm. so we see some patients that have mainly the tremor or the shaking, and we call those tremor predominant. And we see patients that are mainly just slower and stiff, and we call those akinetic rigid. And we say akinetic because kinetic means movement, and A means lack of movement.
Ah,
so this paucity of movement, slowness of movement, and the stiffness, that's another category.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a group that oftentimes can present mainly with gait and balance problems. That's the third type. And then really the fourth type is any combination of the above three. Some have all the symptoms. Some have tremor really as the worst symptom, and gait can be very mild, or they never have a gait problem. So it can be a combination of all those. That's why we have the phrase, right? Snowflakes, because really they aren't. There's no two that are exactly alike.
I think sometimes people think of Parkinson's as an older person's disease, but that's not true, is it? I mean, certainly people get it when they're younger too.
That's right.
Give me like the youngest you've seen, and is there a general age it hits, I guess, first of all, and then how young can it hit?
Well, usually people are probably in their 60s or older, but 4% of people will get it below the age of 50. And I've seen people in their teens that can get it. So that's really unusual. Most people don't think about that because we do think of it as an older person's disease. But there are a fair number of people that can get it in their 30s and 40s.
That's so got to be
unusual.
Very devastating. Charlene, my research person, had a question. Charlene, what was your...
Hi, doctor. I'm curious, can an accident, a brain injury, bring the Parkinson's make it happen or be a part of why someone uh-huh. gets it?
Well, you know, if you have a bad accident that affects that part of the brain, you can get the symptoms that look like Parkinson's disease. But we don't believe that there is a trauma that's going to induce, for example, the same phenomenon of the dopamine cells dying that you see in idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And there are a lot of, actually, the one thing we don't talk about is that there are other disorders that look like Parkinson's disease, but aren't. And the difference is that patients with Parkinson's disease will typically respond to medication, a certain type of medication. We can talk about that a little bit if you like. And we use that almost as a diagnostic tool to diagnose patients with idiopathic Parkinson's disease. There are others that have a more widespread pathology in the brain. It can involve the same circuits as Parkinson's patients, but also it's more extensive and involves other brain areas. So the medication we typically use for Parkinson's disease can typically affect one particular circuit in the brain predominantly, whereas with these other patients, because there are so many other areas of the brain involved, the patients who have symptoms that look like Parkinson's but don't have Parkinson's don't typically respond to the medication.
Interesting.
How common is Parkinson's, and does it differentiate in depending on like what part of the world you live in to how what the rates might be?
Yeah, it can. You know, if you look at race, for example, it's more common as the greatest occurrence in the Hispanic population.
Really?
And then that's followed by Caucasians, and then Asians, and then African Americans. It's not hugely different in the numbers, but but they are different. And, you know, why is that? Well, there are a lot of theories, but no one really has a good explanation for that. There's probably a million people in the United States, more than likely even more than that, but that's the number we all go with, that are diagnosed, that are in the United States. And 60,000 new cases are diagnosed every year in the U.S.
Is there a gender preference?
Well, yeah, you know, it's about 1.5 men to women. There's been some discussion about whether estrogen could be protective somehow, but obviously it's not completely protective because women still get Parkinson's
right,
disease.
Right, right. Interesting. So it's interesting, you know, I think we've had, or at least in my lifetime growing up, we've had some real famous faces to Parkinson's. Sometimes you know, when doing this program, I talk to people and I say, well, why isn't there more research in this particular disease or something? And the guess, you know, I've had people say, well, there's no face to the disease. And it makes a big difference if there's a face to the disease. You feel that that's true? And can you talk about some, like, kind of jog people's memory of what famous people have had Parkinson's?
Best example is the Olympics, as you all recall, right, with Muhammad Ali and the torch.
Oh, yes.
The Olympics. Remember how his hand was shaking?
Yeah.
And I think the thing that really can drive home the point about Parkinson's with Muhammad Ali is, you know, obviously he's standing in front of the whole world, and even a man like Muhammad Ali could be a little anxious in those circumstances, right? And anxiety will make these movement disorders a lot worse. So if you notice his hand shaking, it was pretty severe, pretty significant. And I think the anxiety likely exacerbated that. But he's one person, and a good example of it with the tremor that he had. A lot of people thought that perhaps the boxing was the underlying cause for his Parkinson's disease. And I don't doubt that it contributed to it. But he very likely had idiopathic PD. But I suspect a lot of that was also exacerbated by the injury to his brain through head trauma. Other people,
yeah.
Michael J. Fox is another good example.
Yes,
right?
I do remember that one. And
you ever remember remember the TV interviews he did?
Yeah.
And he was really moving all over the place? Do you remember that?
Yeah, and I do remember him talking about how, you know, he would work through this and he would have to tell them, okay, I'm good now. I can go for a little while. But when it started to get too much, he had to break and wait till he got things under control.
Yep, that's right. The funny thing about that, as a physician watching that who does Parkinson's disease, is some of the people on TV said, well, he hasn't got enough medication.
Yeah.
But the extra movement that he had was caused by the medication.
Wow.
Because, again, Parkinson's disease is a paucity of movement, a lack of movement, inability to make movements or to be slow in your movement. Again, you don't blink your eyes as much. You don't swallow as much. Some people will look like they're drooling, but that's because they aren't swallowing their saliva.
Oh.
So it's, again, this paucity of movement. Michael J. Fox, when he's not taking his medication, will be much more immobile and wouldn't have all those extra movements.
Oh, I
again,
see.
Again, the extra movements are all from the medication.
And
that's not typical. I mean, people don't usually get that right away, but it is a side effect of medication. Over the years, you can start to develop that as a result of the medication.
If I remember right, he was diagnosed incredibly young, like late teens,
yeah.
Early 20s, right?
That's right. He's a good example of young onset Parkinson's.
So
there are other people. I mean, you know, one that struck me was Neil Diamond.
I had no idea that he had it.
For people my age, maybe in the 60s, you remember Neil Diamond very well.
I'm right? With you, yeah.
All right, there you go. That's, you and I are the same. Yeah, we're in that gender and that age range. But he was diagnosed in 2018.
Oh, you're kidding. Like recent. Wow.
Yeah, very recent. Another one is Jesse Jackson was diagnosed in 2015. And if any of you like to watch MASH, Alan Alda was diagnosed in 2015.
Oh, wow. So.
And then remember Janet Reno?
Yes.
That's so right. She was diagnosed in 1995.
Oh. Is, and obviously having a face or having famous people brings not only more money, possibly, but education to the disease.
Yeah, and I think one of the best examples is to show how people live with the disease, and they can live with a high quality of life. A lot of times people will take a diagnosis and feel, oh my goodness, you know, like, what now, what am I going to do? But people can live very well for decades with Parkinson's disease. You know, we can manage the symptoms with medications. There are surgical therapies that are out there now, form of things like deep brain stimulation. We call it brain pacemakers. And all of those things have been very helpful in treating the motor signs of Parkinson's, and really have improved their quality of life dramatically.
So can you talk about how can someone test for Parkinson's? Like, let's say they wonder if they're going to get it, or let's say they've had people in their family have it. Can they, like, pre-test, so to speak, so that they can check to see if they're likely to have it?
Well, you know, for that small percent that have a genetic link, then you can test for it. But really, the vast majority of people do not have a genetic link. And in that case, there really isn't a test that you can do to diagnose it. It's really a clinical diagnosis. And so you'd see a physician, and that physician would look for these motor signs I talked to you about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hear stories from patients saying, my handwriting is smaller. I had trouble rolling over in bed at night. I feel like I have more trouble with fine motor skills, cutting my food, buttoning buttons, things like that. And then you go see a neurologist who specializes in movement disorders, and we can help to sort that out. There is a test that people can use to look at the integrity of the dopamine system.
Okay.
That's called a DAT scan. But it's expensive, and it doesn't really change how we treat patients. So many of us will only use that if we really think the diagnosis is questionable. It's not very clear.
And could that...
Otherwise, no, it's really clinical.
Could that scan, though, it could mean more than one thing is wrong?
Yes.
So
very good.
It feels like it's not even really a definitive answer that's Parkinson's, correct?
You're absolutely right. And that is the hit on those kinds of scans. Now, that kind of scan will tell you about dopamine and mm-hmm. this pathway.
Mm-hmm.
But remember I mentioned those other disorders that look like Parkinson's,
right,
but aren't Parkinson's. They have the damage that Parkinson's patients have, but in addition to that, they have more extensive damage.
Mm-hmm.
They would look the same way in a DAT scan that an idiopathic Parkinson's patient would. The time it's useful is if you have somebody who has a tremor that's an inherited tremor called essential tremor.
Okay.
And this is a tremor that people can get, and they can have it when they're younger. It can progress as they get older. And sometimes patients with Parkinson's only have tremor to start with, a small percent like that. And if you look at those two types of tremors, sometimes they're pretty close, and it's hard to tell the difference. It doesn't really change how we treat people. But there are people who just want to know, is this essential tremor or is this more like Parkinson's disease? And that DAT scan does help in those cases.
Presumably, the people that really want to know are looking towards what kind of treatment I can have if I've got Parkinson's, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
So let's dive into that. Talk about the treatments.
Well, the gold standard, I mean, there's different, I break it into three different things.
Okay.
I mean, early on, we would talk about medical therapy. And there are multiple medications out there, but the gold standard is really dopamine replacement, because that's what you're missing. And that's usually given in the form of something called Sinemet. And that's a combination of DOPA in a form of what they call levodopa, with another chemical called carbidopa that allows the levodopa to get into the brain. And so that really is the gold standard. But there are other things out there that mimic dopamine, and they're called dopamine agonists. And we can use those. There are other drugs, a whole list of them, that work in a similar fashion, and some of them work a little bit differently to treat the symptoms. So medical therapy is a variety of them, and there are more drugs coming out all the time. But bottom line is the gold standard is still going to be Sinemet.
And
when you get to a point that medical therapy is not working as well. So if I were a Parkinson's patient and someone gave me Sinemet, I took one tablet, let's say three times a day, I might do very, very well for years. Over time, however, the medication may not last quite as long. So then I have to either give more medication or I have to move the doses closer together. So instead of someone taking it, let's say 8 o'clock, 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock, now I start taking it at 8 o'clock, 12 o'clock and 4 o'clock. And then I may need a dose at 8 o'clock at night. And that's kind of the way it goes. And over time, as the doses become less effective, you end up moving them closer together.
So,
or you can just increase the dose and keep the spacing the same. All kinds of ways to approach this. But again, it's the combination of medications.
With the dopamine...
When the medications...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
With the dopamine replacements, is that where you get the extra movements then? Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah, that's right. Usually it doesn't happen right away, though. It's about 10% per year of patients will develop some extra movements. By the time you're being treated for 5 years, a certain percent of patients are going to start developing these extra movements. And they can be quite mild at first. But as you go on, there's less of a buffering system in our brain to store the dopamine that we take orally. And the dose you get kind of goes up, the blood level goes up, and then you get the extra movements. When the blood level drops down, the movements will tend to go away. But they definitely come strictly from the medication.
Go ahead.
The other therapy,
as you
progress in the disease, the medical therapy, again, can be unpredictable. You might take a dose that doesn't work anymore, and the next dose will work. Or let's say you take a dose and you think, I should be good for 3 hours. So what happens is I get 1 hour into my dose, and all of a sudden all my symptoms come back, and I'm not under control anymore. So the unpredictability becomes a real problem for people. If you can imagine going to the grocery store and saying, I'm going to go out and I'm going to shop. I've got 3 hours when medication is going to work. And then you get to the grocery store and you're walking down the aisle picking up your groceries. And all of a sudden your medication doesn't work anymore.
Oh, geez.
And you're unable to move. You're slow. You're stiff. Your tremor comes back. And all of a sudden people start looking at you. And you get embarrassed and you get anxious. And the symptoms get worse. You can understand how that's got to be difficult for people.
Right.
So there are surgical therapies now where we can implant like a pacemaker lead deep in the brain structures that are affected in Parkinson's, and we can produce some pretty significant improvement in their symptoms. Turn the clock back at least 5 years in most patients.
Really?
That's interesting.
Yeah, and you can reduce the medication as well.
So how does that work?
Well, that's a good question. I've been doing that since 2003, actually, working on that question. Well, it changes the pattern of neural activity in the brain. So when you lose dopamine, the brain patterns go awry is probably the best way I could explain this.
Mm-hmm.
They're not under control anymore. And the stimulation tends to bring them back into a pattern that the rest of the brain circuitry can adapt to. And so we see pretty marked improvements in these patients.
So
I could go into a lot more detail, but I don't think you'd want to hear all the details. It works well.
Is there a progression? Like, do they generally start out with drug therapy and move to something like this? Or is there a reason why they wouldn't start out with this at the beginning? Because it sounds like it'd be a whole lot less troublesome than the drug therapy.
Well, you know, the labeling for doing the brain pacemakers has changed.
Oh.
It used to be from the FDA, you had to have a really advanced PD, intractable problems, and then you'd be a candidate. They've moved that back now to having been diagnosed for 4 years. And at that point, if you have trouble, then the FDA has approved deep brain stimulation. The difference is, and the reason people don't do it right away, is you really don't need to start right away. We think that could there be a protective effect of the stimulation, you would be able to prevent people from getting dyskinesia because you're decreasing the medication and they don't have to take as much to start with.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is, though, is that medical therapy, you can take a dose and you do really well. The side effects really aren't going to develop for years. With deep brain stimulation, there's a 1% to 2% risk that you'll have a stroke when the lead is put in.
Jeez. Oh, that's
so
not kind.
So you have a 90% chance. Well, you know, you've got a pretty good chance that's not going to happen. But
right.
If you don't need to take that risk,
I see.
I think most people, if they feel medication works for them, they're not inclined to do so.
So, there's always more, right? But the downside of the dopamine replacement, are you saying, is generally that eventually it just doesn't work as it did at the beginning, after a while?
In certain ways, it doesn't work. So typically, it becomes unpredictable. Mm-hmm. So one dose may work, another dose may not.
Mm-hmm.
You may have what we call a narrow therapeutic window over time, whereas early on, I can give you the drug, medication's going to work, your symptoms abate. You may stay like that for 3-4 hours, and then the symptom will come back. Whereas after a number of years of taking dopamine, the symptoms are unpredictable. So they may go away, and then they may come back right away. So we call motor fluctuations. So they appear, then they disappear, but you can't predict when. And so that becomes very cumbersome and difficult for people's quality of life. And remember, it's a progressive disease. So it's not just that you've lost 70% of these cells, which is the case at diagnosis. Over time, you continue to lose more of those cells.
And what about the
deep... It becomes more difficult.
The deep brain stimulation. Is there, besides the stroke, which is significant if you do have one, is there a downside with doing that?
You know, the only problem that you would see, I think the biggest issue here is the analogy I draw to deep brain stimulation effectiveness is like selling real estate. It's location, location, location.
Huh.
So the lead has to be very precisely placed. So when patients look at places that they think would be a good place to go, they need to know that that place has a lot of experience. They do a lot of cases, and then you need to find out how well the cases do and talk to people who've had it done there. Because I think that's the biggest factor in the effect of deep brain stimulation. But it can be extremely effective. And again, if you're at a point where you're fluctuating a lot, the medication sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You're having dyskinesias, you can't control those. You don't know when you're going to turn off or you're going to freeze in place, you can't move. That's a pretty lousy quality of life.
Mm, yes.
And if you look at the risk is really relatively small, and you're talking 1-2%, that's pretty low for brain surgery.
And if you're talking about the deep brain stimulation, how often do you have to do that?
Once. So you put the lead in once, but now for most patients, you end up going to put a lead on each side of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
If I put a lead on the right side of the brain, it's going to improve symptoms on the left side of the body. Mm-hmm. So you're going to need to put the other side in to control the right side of the body.
Mm-hmm.
But once you put those in, provided you have good placement, you don't replace them again unless there's a malfunction. And typically the devices are so good now that they will last virtually for quite a long time. The only change you have to make is like a cardiac pacemaker.
Ah.
You've got a little pulse generator that generates the current placed under the clavicle, under the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is under the skin. And, you know, some of those devices, if you don't have a rechargeable device, you replace it every maybe 4 to 5 years.
Right.
In other cases, you have rechargeables that can last 15 years. You wouldn't have to replace it for 15 years.
Oh, so you plug in at night, huh?
Jeez.
Pretty much,
that's
yeah.
So
watch TV
so...
and hook yourself up.
Oh, boy.
Me and the iPhone, okay.
pretty much.
So did you say there's a third treatment?
Well, the other thing I would like to tell people who are listening is that there are some very basic things that are extremely good for helping you when you have disability of Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest things is exercise.
Ah, we hear this the time.
Oh, well, you know, we should all do it.
Yes.
But the exercise for Parkinson's, there have been some studies that have suggested that it actually can help with releasing more dopamine.
Ah.
And things like spinning. Cycling. People have talked about Tai Chi, and you've heard about the boxing, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think all these things, anything you do like that is going to be good for you. But there are some studies that were done when I was working at the Cleveland Clinic, where we did some studies a guy named Jay Alberts, and we did cycling, and there was an able-bodied trainer on a tandem bike with a Parkinson's patient on the back of the bike. Mm-hmm. And he generated this study where the able-bodied trainer would go very fast, and the person behind the Parkinson's patient would try to follow, but because it's a tandem bike,
right,
their legs are moving just as fast as the able-bodied trainer was.
Right.
And those patients, after exercising a certain period of time for 5 days, you know, it was like they're on for like an hour or something in the bike, mm-hmm. and then they did it for 5 days in a row, and we saw marked improvement in their motor signs, you know, in their stiffness, rigidity, the tremor. That lasted several days, almost out for a week or two in some cases. And so if you do spinning 3-4 times a week, I tell all my patients that are able to do it, that they should do something like that. But even if you just go to the gym and you, or if you walk at a fast pace, mm-hmm. all of those things are going to be helpful. And diet, nutrition.
Yes.
All those things that you and I, all of us really used to do, can be extremely helpful for patients with Parkinson's.
The thing is, what do you follow? There's so many stuff, so much different diets now, meatless, you know, vegan, whatever the other thing is that now vegans decided they should add meat, no dairy, soy. Yep. So how do you know what you should follow?
It's tough. If you go on and look at the APDA or Parkinson's Foundation websites, they do talk about diets, not really a diet, not we're trying to lose weight, it's the things you're eating.
Right.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about antioxidants and their role in Parkinson's disease. So foods that are high in these types of things are what people think are good. Look, it's not going to stop Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. We don't know if it'll even slow it down. But there's been enough scientific data suggesting that these types of foods might be good for you. So it's not going to hurt you. It's probably good for all of us. And if you think there's something, a chance that it could help, then I think you should take it. And it's not that hard to do. Again, those websites will tell you what those types of foods are. The biggest thing still, I think, goes back to exercise.
Is there a difference in
and
how
that's
you...
something, again, we should all do.
Yeah. Is there a difference in how you treat a patient if they come in diagnosed at the age of 20 as opposed to 60?
You know, not really. Again, what I tell everybody who comes in, I mean, what I would tell someone who's 20 clearly is exercise vigorously. Someone at 60, I'm going to make sure that their family practitioner or internal medicine doc has assessed them that they're able to do that kind of exercise.
Okay.
Because it appears like the exercise that you have to do is vigorous exercise for a small amount of time is better than moderate exercise for a long period of time. So you want to make sure you're in good shape for that. But again, for a younger patient or an older patient, I think what we tell them is very much the same thing. And we treat them the same way.
We need to take a small break and we'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. Are you still living and breathing? Then you are in recovery from something. That's what my podcast, Authentic, is about. All things recovery. I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a compulsive gambler. A bipolar disorder. Really, the list could go on and on and on. However, the show isn't about me. Every Friday, a new episode airs featuring a guest who shares their experience, strength, and hope as it pertains to what they are in recovery from. If we help one person, then we have done our job. Guests on Authentic smash stigma, share solutions, and provide my favorite four-letter word, hope. You can listen to Authentic on KFAI.org or whatever podcast platform you use. Remember, be good to yourselves. It's important.
We're here with Dr. Gerald Vitek. And Dr. Vitek, what are some myths that you have heard people say or think about Parkinson's?
Well, you know, one thing is that people always feel that if to have Parkinson's, you have to have tremor. And you don't, as I mentioned. There are many, many, many Parkinson's patients that don't have tremor, for example. The other thing, it's not just a movement problem. So people with Parkinson's often have mood disorder. When they're first diagnosed, about 30% of Parkinson's patients have depression. And by the time they're more advanced, it's closer to 50%.
Wow.
And dopamine, again, affects more than just movement. It also affects mood. And if you think about anybody, if you guys golf, I don't much. I have friends who like to, so they take me out the course every now and then. And I think just for grins to watch me, you know, knock balls all over the place.
Nice.
But every now and then, you know, I get lucky and I hit something right. And when that happens, you feel pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And what happens when in your brain is that there are parts of your brain that are being bathed in dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be a feel-good drug. And when you lose that drug, not in addition to the movement problems, your mood can be depressed.
Yeah.
And again, 30% at diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you need to treat that because that's a major factor for quality of life. The other things that Parkinson's patients have pretty commonly are sleep disorders.
Ah. Sleep disorders.
And you can think about if, well, go ahead.
Like,
what's your question?
Like not enough sleep, too much? What type?
No, their sleep cycles get screwed up. So, you know, usually you go through different phases of sleep. And we have people in my department that focus strictly on this. But they may not go through their sleep cycles the way you and I might go through our sleep cycles. The other thing they can have is what they call excessive daytime sleepiness. And that's oftentimes due to the medication we give them.
Mm.
So the Cinemat and these dopamine agonists I talk about, they can make people sleepy. So we have to adjust things for that.
Even though they're making them feel good.
Well, yeah, it's true. Not everybody responds the same way. And I know there are some patients with Parkinson's who just hate, you know, being off. And when I say off, it means when the symptoms are at their worst.
Mm-hmm.
So they're slow, they're stiff, and they have trouble making movements. Some people can freeze where they get stuck in one spot and can't move again. And people just hate that. You can understand why.
Yes.
So what those people often do is they'll overdose on the dopamine because they don't want to be in that state. And that can be an addictive drug.
I was just going to ask that.
Like heroin or cocaine or
right.
Something like that. But it does make you feel better. And I know there's one patient of mine years ago when I was at Emory. I would see her in the hallway because she was working with us, with our patient population. She had a surgery done, and she would help us with patients who were thinking of surgery. I saw her in the hallway, and she looked just fine, but she said, and we were on a first-name basis, she said, "Jerry, I really need my medication." I remember saying, "Well, Terry, you look fine." She goes, "No, you don't understand. I really need my medication. I just feel anxious. I'm nervous. I just don't feel good." And yet, movement-wise, she was fine. When she took her medication, that all went away. So, you know, there's anxiety, discomfort, and a lot of that can be related to the lack of dopamine.
So, because her dopamine levels were still low then, even after
yes.
after the surgery, it doesn't necessarily raise dopamine levels, but it will help.
Well, the surgery we did then actually was something called a palatotomy, is a lesion surgery. That's since been replaced by the deep brain stimulation because side effects of deep brain stimulation due to the stimulation are reversible. You can adjust the amount of current that we give people, and so we can, you know, increase it or decrease it.
Okay.
With the lesion surgery, you really can't take it away. It's done. And lesion surgery didn't allow us to reduce the medication. So she had a palatotomy because there was no DBS available then. But now, with DBS, we can reduce the medication. So it's a very different surgical approach than what we used to do back in the 90s, early 90s.
So the people who are famous that we talked about, Michael J. Fox, he's still with us, right?
Yeah.
I think he's still. What do they generally opt to do? Do they tough it out with the dopamine first to see if they can level things out, or do they go for the deep brain surgeries?
Well, I've been surprised that I haven't seen that Michael J. Fox has had this done, and I've always wondered why not, because it can improve the quality of life so much for so many people. That's always surprised me he hasn't had it done, and the extra movements he has, the dyskinesias respond extremely well to the surgical therapy. But, you know, everybody has a different perspective on this, and some people will want to do it very early in the course of their disease. And others will hold out until they feel they just can't hold on anymore.
Presumably because the risk, once you have the stroke, you know, there's no going back from there, right?
Well, and I, you know, when someone tells you that, so if I were to tell you, if you came to me and say I was an oncologist, and I said, well, you know, you have this cancer, and you have a 50-50 chance, and what do you think about? You think, I don't think about a 50% chance I'm going to live. I think that's a 50% chance I'm going to die.
Right.
I think that's what most people tend to see it as. Now, there are some that are very optimistic. You know, I'm one of those glass half empty kind of guys, unfortunately. So I would see it as, well, I have a 2% chance or 1% chance I could have a stroke. Whereas others see it as, I have a 99% or 98% chance I'm going to come through this, and I'm going to do a whole lot better, and my quality of life is going to be a lot better. It's a very personal decision for people.
Right. And you talked about progression in the disease, and it's clear that what you've said is the progression doesn't necessarily happen the same for everyone. Correct?
That's correct. It's pretty different. I have a friend of mine who I take care of, and we talk not infrequently, and the question oftentimes comes up, what am I going to be like next year? What I tell people, although I don't know that it's perfectly accurate, is take a look at what you're like last year, look at what you're like now, and you can project ahead to next year. That's not always the case, because I do think people in the early stages, the vast majority, will do well for quite some time. Mood and, you know, attitude has a lot to do with that, but on the other hand, it's going to progress. Mm-hmm. But it just progresses so differently in different people.
Is some of that...
When people ask you, you really can't tell them.
Right.
Is some of that difference maybe because people have other underlying medical conditions that don't play nice with the Parkinson's?
Well, that's a great question. I think it certainly can be. We can't rule out that other things can play a role in that. Could they hasten the progression of disease? If you think about, if you have other illnesses and you're already having trouble with your walking, you have another disorder that compromises your Parkinson's. Yeah, it's true. It can make it worse. Whether it makes it progress faster, that's another question. I mean, I don't know. We don't know what the factors are that makes those cells die out over time. We know that there are some molecular changes in those cells, that there are some little protein deposits called alpha-synuclein that we think could be an underlying cause that might kill those cells. On the other hand, it could just be a result of some other process. And it's what we call an epiphenomena. It doesn't cause it, but it's a byproduct of something else that's going on. And this is what people really don't understand, and that's where a lot of the science and the research has gone, is to understanding those molecular mechanisms that underlie that cell death. If you can understand that, then you can develop perhaps ways to stop that or at least slow it down.
Can you talk about what people should look for? Like, how do they know if they should even be looking at this type of thing, and how do they pick a good neurologist?
Well, if you're talking about Parkinson's patients, period, and then
right.
and then whether you should have deep brain stimulation done, what you'd want to do really is to find a good movement disorder neurologist, someone that's been trained and knows movement disorders and takes care of Parkinson's patients, because a lot of times, most people can handle Parkinson's early in the course, but as things get more complicated, it gets harder. And when you're a physician that focuses strictly on taking care of Parkinson's patients, you've learned a few more tricks of the trade, I think, and the ways
yes.
that you can improve their therapies. And so I really think the first step is to find a good movement disorder neurologist and get an assessment and follow with that person. But remember, if you don't, this is a relationship that you develop. And if that relationship doesn't feel right to you, then you can find another person who does movement disorders and work with that person. That physician should help you to understand, when do you think you're at a point that you should think about brain pacemakers or deep brain stimulation? And again, that's a personal decision. So some people will go early and not want to put up with some of these fluctuations or the extra movements at all. Others will put up with it for quite some long time because they're concerned about the surgery. I would say if you're even thinking about it, you should go to a center that does deep brain stimulation
mm-hmm.
And talk to the neurologist there just about, you know, what is deep brain stimulation? Am I a candidate? Why would I be a candidate? Are there things that would make me higher risk than somebody else? what's your what are your results like? Can I talk to some patients who've had it done here? All you're doing when you do that is inquiring, mm-hmm. just to get information. You don't have to have the surgery done by making a visit to your movement disorder neurologist. You're just getting information. That's what I recommend everybody do. And if you're not sure about it with that person, then go talk to another one who also does it and get a sense. This has to be right for you, and you've got to feel good about the people you're working with.
Second opinions, I can't stress enough on. But I have a real hard realization of how insurances sometimes work for people.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes they penalize you for not kind of, quote, making up your mind, if that's what you want to call it.
Well, I agree. You know, when there were some changes in our healthcare system some years ago, one of my ex-mentees from another institution told me that he had a patient been following for quite some time. It was his patient. They had a relationship established. And when the insurance changed, that patient who was going to have surgery with my colleague was not allowed to anymore. That's not a good outcome, in my opinion.
No.
I don't know how you change, the network of insurance companies, et cetera, to avoid that, but that is a problem. Usually, though, you can find within a network, a couple of people that know about this field and get a second opinion from them.
So do you feel that the general physician is up on things enough to recognize Parkinson's?
Well, you know, if you look at the numbers, what people say is that people in internal medicine or family practice miss the diagnosis about 25% of the time.
Ugh.
And even people with specialty areas in movement disorders, people that see Parkinson's patients, mm-hmm. can be wrong 10% of the time. So there's nothing that's 100%, right?
Right.
But I would say that if you have a question of whether you have Parkinson's disease, you should see a specialist in movement disorders who, again, works primarily with Parkinson's patients.
Can you talk about any studies or research that's going on, and where can people find out about them?
So we have a website at the University of Minnesota and the Department of Neurology. It's actually being updated. So if you get on and look at it today, you're not going to see what we want you to see. But you will see a list of things that are being done at the University of Minnesota, as well as within our department. So it's not just our neurology department that does work in Parkinson's disease. The basic neuroscience departments do. Some of the imaging centers do. People in biomedical engineering do. And we have a large cadre of people at this institution that have formed teams. And we have a large team of people here that work on understanding, what causes those cells to die, what changes in the brain when you have Parkinson's disease. And there are a lot of work being done at this institution looking at the changes in your brain when you get Parkinson's disease. We have what's called the Udall Center of Excellence for Parkinson's Disease here.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are 9 in the country, and we were fortunate to get one a couple of years ago. And that deals a lot with understanding the circuits in Parkinson's disease and how deep brain stimulation can improve that and how to improve deep brain stimulation in general. And that's all over our websites. And we have a lot of clinical trials looking at deep brain stimulation. We also have a lot of clinical trials looking at medical therapy for Parkinson's and other movement disorders. There are a number of imaging studies that are being looked at here. There are studies looking at people's gait and their balance, studies looking at different sites to stimulate in. And there are people, again, looking at the molecular bases underlying the development of Parkinson's. So there's all kinds of work that's being done at this institution. This is, I came back to Minnesota about 9 years ago. I've been gone 26 years across the country. And I came back for two reasons. One, we wanted to come home, but that wasn't the biggest reason. The biggest reason was the quality of the science at this institution, and the neuroscience in particular. So this is a very strong site for circuits and neuroscience and imaging, et cetera, that deals particularly with things like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and muscle diseases.
So one of the good places to go if you've got to go there.
Well, I would tend to be a little biased, probably. but I do think it is. I mean, I've been all over the country. spent time in upstate New York, spent time at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, down to Emory University in Atlanta for 14 years, Cleveland Clinic for six. And then, you know, we came back to Minnesota. We were very happy back in the state. Last couple of days didn't completely change my mind.
But, I was going to say.
But, you know, it's a hardy group up here.
That's true. That's right.
And so, I think this is a very good, very good place for the science, but also for the clinical care. We have very good people to take care of patients here.
I know this may be way off, so if it is, just say so. But in a lot of different areas, they're experimenting / trying things with stem cell. Is there anything that stem cells can do in this area?
Sure. And, you know, they have a very good stem cell group. In fact, our in that area in stem cells, Jacob Toller. And there's a lot of work that people are developing of stem cells. When we first started talking about stem cells, we thought we'd find a cure for Parkinson's disease. It's been a lot slower than that. But there is still a lot of work being done on stem cells. So that's just another area that people are looking at. It's really a multifaceted approach. You know, can you replace the dopamine by putting cells in the brain that will make dopamine or replace the cells that were making dopamine before? And that was the whole concept behind stem cells and transplant of tissue that would replace dopamine. It didn't go as quickly as we thought it would, but there's still advances that are being made using stem cells. There are other things. There's gene therapy that people are looking at.
So there's
a variety of different things that are going on here as well as other places.
But presumably,
just recently I saw something on a couple of new drugs that were being developed that people thought not only could be more effective at treating the symptoms, but potentially could be protective of those cells that are remaining that make dopamine. So, you know, there's things, I guess what we need to tell people is that there's an awful lot of work being done in this field. And, you know, you could find something could occur tomorrow, a new discovery. If you go back to levodopa, I mean, levodopa was discovered. People had nothing before levodopa. And when levodopa came into play, it was a huge change for people that had nothing before that.
Right.
And everybody thought, well, now we've got a treatment for Parkinson's. But then after 5-10 years, they realized, there are some problems with medical therapy. May create issues down the road. And then surgical therapies came back, and that was the deep brain stimulation world. And that's a big change for people. So, you know, the next discovery could be tomorrow morning when you wake up and see in the paper, new drug. Right? So I think people should keep hope because there's a lot of smart people looking at a lot of different ways to beat this disease.
When do you think the university website will be working well again for people to be able to access studies and whatnot?
Well, I was hoping it would have been yesterday, but unfortunately, that's not how it works here. So I would hope within a few weeks, maybe no later than a month. I think we're in the queue. We've modified everything in our department, and so we're in the queue at the university to get our website up with new additions. But in the meantime, if people want to give a call to our department, they can find us. There's a website with an address and a number for contacts. They're more than welcome to call, and we would direct them.
Do you want to give a number or website out that people can?
You know, if you just get on the University of Minnesota website and look under neurology, we still have something there.
Okay.
It's not updated like it should be, but you'll see some things there. But I can actually just give you, I'll give you my admin assistant will love this, but I'm going to give out a number here.
Go for it.
Direct people.
Okay.
And that's it's 612-625-5993.
Can you give that once more?
Yep. 612-625-5993. And we can try to direct those folks to the right place.
Dr. Vitek, it's been awesome. Is there anything you'd like to share with us that we've missed or anything you'd like to say before we leave?
No, you guys have been really thorough. The last thing I would leave you with would be just a little story, and that was when I was a medical student, we were always being told that you should not get too connected with your patients. Right? That was the old story, right? I would tell you now that has changed, and that's not how we practice in this department. We believe you have to have a relationship with your patient, that they have to know that we care about them as people. We care about how their families are dealing with these disorders as well as with the patient. And so I would leave that thought that there's been a big change in the mantra for how physicians take care of patients, particularly at this institution. And it's very personal and patient specific.
Kind of like treating the person as a whole.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's not just the disease. That disease affects the family, affects the kids.
Yes.
It affects the extended family. It affects them socially. It affects them financially. You need to treat everything. You're right. It's treat the patient as a whole.
Dr. Vitek, thank you so, so much for coming on. We greatly appreciate your time. And
my pleasure.
We will look forward to having you back on when we get another awesome cure come in, or treatment. I guess cure is the wrong thing, but treatment maybe is a better word to use, huh?
Well, let's hope it's sooner rather than later, right?
Let's hope so. Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome.
KPI.org.